This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Bob Fetrakis bringing you once again The Other Side of the News. I'm in the studio here with Austin Coker of the Central Ohio Workers' Center, who will be responding to the proposals by President Barack Obama, as well as commenting and analyzing local events here in Central Ohio involving Angel Bustos and his release from custody, where he was taken into custody by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Welcome to The Other Side of the News.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Okay, very busy and eventful week. And again, the key events we want you to analyze is what's happening in terms of immigration policy. It seems like the president had three initiatives. I don't know how new they were. It seemed like many of them have been floating around for a while. It appears to affect 5 million workers. Do you want to go over those policy proposals with the listeners?
I do. Yeah, it's important to remember that just a week ago, we really had no idea that this was going to be announced. A week ago, we were working on cases for immigrant families here in Ohio who were very uncertain about what was going to happen. Now, a week later, we have some pretty distinct policy, and even though we're waiting to see how it actually is going to be put into practice, we have some hope. We have much more hope than we had a week ago. On Thursday night, Obama announced that he was going to allow some immigrants who are here without paperwork to stay, to remain in the United States, along a set of priorities that had already been in the been proposed through the Senate legislation 2 years ago, which got stalled in the House and which have sat there for the last year and a half. And the policies are the criteria for those immigrants are actually pretty straightforward. So we can discuss what that looks like.
Now, when we're looking at this, it seems the three areas affected. One, of course, were essentially the undocumented parents of children who are American citizens. Would this be related to the Angel Bustos case?
That's right. So Angel would benefit directly from the announcements on Thursday night, more than likely. The three main areas that Obama announced were, number one, as we could expect, increased funding for border security. And it's important to be a little bit more cautious about that than he was in his own speech, because the main funding in this announcement, it seems to me, is that this is a huge announcement for funding for more border security, which, as we know, is actually part of the reason that we have long-term migration from Latin America to the United States in the first place. So,
well, wouldn't it be? Are they talking about militarizing the border here?
Yes, it's been militarized dramatically over the last 20 years, mm-hmm. and all we're going to see is just a continued ramp up of that.
What seems so odd is the European Union, another economic integration model, seems to have far more open borders for its members. And we, particularly in regards to Mexico, which is part of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the trade zone, we seem to have gone in a different direction. Why is that?
Well, we've been very Janus-faced about our economic policy. We want goods to move back and forth and finance to move back and forth. But for some reason, we've been, you know, blind or have tried to shut our eyes to the fact that there are people who are going to naturally move back and forth as well.
Particularly with the disruption of the Mexican economy.
Yes.
In many ways, I mean, the real victims of NAFTA were the smaller and medium-sized companies in Mexico that were in no position to compete with Canadian corporations and U.S. corporations.
That's right. U.S. companies could then very easily move in and use their financial power mm-hmm. to buy up medium and small-sized farms. Similar along the industrialization lines, they moved a lot of factories there, mm-hmm. which put local economy, local factories and local economic business businesses out and moved U.S. businesses in, which, yeah, it had a dramatically disrupting effect. In fact, they benefited hugely from moving those factories right across the border and drawing millions of people up towards the U.S.-Mexico border for jobs. And then actually in a very short amount of time, many of those factories moved on to other places and left people jobless along
many
the border.
Many went to China when China received preferred nation trade status.
That's right.
But the so-called maquiladoras, which really had horrendous conditions.
Very terrible.
The reports, in some areas, over 1 million people in one municipality with no water and sewage plant.
That's right. And the response has been, given that they know the kind of negative effect this has had on the Mexican economy, especially in the north, militarizing the border has the perceived benefit of trying to make sure that the people that the United States companies disaffect in Latin America don't have a chance to move to the United States and find more jobs and get more help. I see it as a kind of geopolitical strategy to make sure that U.S. companies reap all the benefits but never have to pay the consequences.
One of the interesting debates that has gone on is the fact that the European Union set a continental minimum wage, mm-hmm. has a parliament, and I saw a U.S. official once say, well, NAFTA contains an agreement on minimum wage, and it does. It means each country will enforce their minimum wage. I know for a long period of time, that meant that Mexico would enforce a minimum wage of 58 cents an hour.
That's right. Yeah.
So it was hardly this lifting upward or a compromise between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico.
Yeah.
It was essentially an agreement that said that Mexico could keep incredibly low minimum wages and enforce, and they agreed to enforce their environmental policies, which were non-enforcement was in the free trade zone.
That's right. I mean, and that's the kind of policy, that's as close to what we can get as calling something like worker rights or worker justice that actually makes it into the law, which I think we should say is not anything close to worker justice. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not a flat minimum wage.
Well, then you had the portion of the bill that dealt with the Dreamers. Were you satisfied with that?
No. What we saw in the final point was around undocumented immigrants, and we saw the Dreamer program. You know, the Dreamer program was a policy to say that if you came here as a child, not under your own will, if you came here undocumented, that you should not be. You know, you should not be punished for those actions, and that you should be allowed to remain here legally. That helped, you know, millions of people stay here legally. That program has been expanded to about another 300,000 individuals. We think that's great. But what's the people that still got left out of the bill were those family members of Dreamers as well, who may not necessarily benefit from the details of the final piece of the announcement.
So you mean their mom and dad, their caregiver, their grandparents, if they were the caregivers?
Mm-hmm, that's right. So the final piece of the executive action includes how the provisions or the criteria for allowing undocumented immigrants that are here and deportable to not be deported. And those four criteria, if you want to say, that the threshold that you have to meet as an individual to benefit and apply is you have to have U.S. citizen children or legal permanent resident children. That's the first. And Dreamers are probably not going to count as that. They're not legal permanent residents, and they're not U.S. citizens. So that's sort of the first criteria. The second is evidence of paying taxes while you've been in the United States. The third is you'll have to submit to a criminal background check. And implicitly, you'll have to not meet some of the priority criteria that Obama has laid out for who they will target for deportation. And lastly, you have to have evidence or records of having been in the U.S. 5 years. If individuals can meet that criteria and apply with the paperwork and evidence of that, they will potentially benefit from this program and be allowed to remain at least provisionally in the U.S. without fear of deportation.
I thought it was a little odd he was stressing, and maybe for political reasons it's not odd, that high-tech, highly skilled immigrants would be allowed to stay here easily after graduation. And what I was thinking is that's already pretty much policy, right?
That is.
I've run across many corporations who have argued that the foreign worker they had is the only one in the local market. I mean, it's routine immigration business. If you're a corporate immigration attorney, that's how they spend a lot of time, is making sure that that highly skilled foreign national will remain after graduation.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so that second provision about getting and keeping high-skilled labor, workers here, it's not much of a change. It's an attempt to streamline a process that's already quite advantageous to employers. Mm. But I think it is a symptom, though, of just how disorganized and confusing the immigration system is. Even that, corporate attorneys and corporate immigration attorneys still struggle even with that area of the law, which is really designed for only the most advantageous and highly educated individuals, and benefits really just the high-tech industry.
Now, the recent attention to the children coming in from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, countries where the U.S. has often been criticized for heavy-handed interventions and backing death squads and right-wing governments, why don't they fall under any refugee or asylee standards?
That's right. It's very disappointing. And in fact, they do. Most of them do can apply for asylum once they get to the United States. And I've seen a number of these cases. People who have very good cases. I've actually done some of the background research around some of these applications to try to make a case. Unfortunately, as we said about the border, there's a kind of a two-faced approach to Latin America, where it's seen as a political object. The United States has a right. It perceives ever since the Monroe Doctrine over almost 200 years ago. The United States sees Latin America as its political object, but it doesn't take accountability for that. And so there's a long-standing problem in asylum law, where it's relatively easier to get asylum from other countries in Africa and East Asia, particularly communist or historically communist countries, even such as Cuba, where getting asylum was relatively straightforward. But from Latin America, places where the United States has intervened militarily, it has been very reticent to grant asylum to those cases.
One of the way that was dealt with in the 1980s is the so-called sanctuary movement.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Where the churches, and I had participated in that movement in Detroit, but families who came up essentially lived in progressive churches, many of the Catholic churches. And I'm wondering, why isn't there an equivalent going on for these children? Is there an equivalent sanctuary movement?
There is, actually. There have been a number of churches, not here. There are a number of churches in Central Ohio who have put themselves up for that if families need that. But so far, there hasn't been that case. There's been a number of cases in Chicago, especially. I've been interested to see a number of Catholic and also Protestant churches that have hosted these children and their families who come essentially as refugees, but are viewed essentially as people who are targeted for deportation. And they have. It has not achieved, I think, as much political attention, but on the ground, it has done a lot for some families.
Now, I don't really know the impact of NAFTA on this, but the recent death of 43, trainee teachers, or teachers in training, who had conflicts with the local police and were turned over to drug cartels. It would seem that the systems and situations within Mexico are so horrendous that virtually anyone coming up from there would have a good argument for being a refugee.
That's true. In many cases, they would meet some ground of the asylum law, just legally, on its face, yes.
What is the Central Ohio Workers Center that you're affiliated with? What is that center hoping to do by being involved in immigration issues? It's a workers center. Mm-hmm. Why the connection to immigration law?
Well, as a workers center, we're interested in making sure that all workers can work in a safe environment, to feel supported, to have recourse if they're injured on the job, to get medical care, One of the big problems we face in Central Ohio is wage theft, where employers do not pay either the hourly wage that they promised, or they don't pay a week's worth of salary sometime, or wages at some time. And so we just want to see workers get paid at least what they've agreed to get paid, and to be safe on the job. That's our broad mission. And within that mission, we know that many of the workers that are most vulnerable also happen to be immigrant, not exclusively, but many. And so the overlap for us is simply very practical. Many of the people who are discriminated in the workplace may also be discriminated in the immigration system. So for us, it's a very straightforward bridge. And so when we hear the announcement, actually most of us who are volunteers at the Central Ohio Worker Center watched the presidential announcement with friends and family members who are immigrants themselves and who would benefit. And our first response is really just to make sure that we get good information out to potential applicants. It's very easy because this policy is policy, it's law, it's governmental language, it's not easy to just understand and read. For any person who's not a lawyer, who doesn't work in this field, we want to make sure that we get out really good quality information that's been proofed by attorneys, and we want to help the people who may benefit from this, not only to get the right paperwork, but to walk them through these four criteria that people have to meet. Each one requires documentation, and so it would be as if you or I had to document what we've been doing for the last 5 years or 10 years of our life. We don't always keep paperwork on everything, and so sometimes we just need to work with them and help them make sure that they provide more than enough evidence, so that the government has no excuse, we hope, to deny people who should benefit from this.
Yeah, I went after the bar exam here in Ohio, and they just wanted to know where I'd lived since I was 18. It took a couple weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know. And that was only one requirement. It wasn't what I was doing all that time. You're listening to WCRS 98.3 and 102.1, your community voice. We're in the studio here with Austin Coker of the Central Ohio Workers Center. We're talking about Obama's recent proposals to reform immigration law in America. And now we're turning to a local case that the Workers Center was heavily involved with, Angel or Angel Bustos, who was in custody for a couple weeks by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. My understanding is that he's been released.
That's right. We're really happy about the outcome of this case, at least in the short term. Angel was taken into custody while checking in with an immigration officer, very unexpected for him and his family. And so we rallied around his family, put his family out in front. They did a fantastic job, really, of working on his behalf. And just this past Wednesday, after a little over 2 weeks in detention, Angel was released from Butler County, Ohio, down in the southwest near Cincinnati. And we're very glad to say that by Wednesday night, he was back home with his family, with his son, who he spoke of a lot. When I spoke to him in detention, he was very concerned about his son's well-being and his wife's well-being. He was back with his family Wednesday night. Thursday night, he came out and he spoke publicly with those of us who gathered to watch the presidential announcement. He spoke outside and was just wonderful and articulate. It was great. He's really, really moved the audience to see people who are going to benefit from this and then watch the announcement with us. And he is exactly this kind of person that if we hadn't rallied around him as a family and as a community, and with all those allies who helped sign the petition, almost 600 signatories to the petition, he could have been back in Mexico by the beginning of this week. And once someone is deported, he would not have benefited from the presidential action. So really, it was a very timely intervention, and we're really thankful for all the people who supported him. Unfortunately, his case is not over. He still has a pending case. He too, like everyone else, will have to go through the application process. So it is a short-term victory, and one we're happy about, but we still need to see more widespread actual immigration reform in the future.
Now, the president seemed to emphasize that ICE, as the enforcement agency, should be focusing on dangerous criminals, violent criminals. Clearly, Angel did not fit into that category. So what was happening in that case?
Well, this case, like many cases, illustrates just how contradictory the policy and the practices around immigration enforcement. Even in the official documents, the annual reports that ICE puts out about deportation numbers, they regularly put, as their first or second sentence, we focus on criminal enforcement. But then when you're out there, you actually look at the cases of people sitting in detention. They're people like Angel, no criminal record, not a threat to national security, not a threat to anyone. But he's sitting in detention, and is treated as if he were a priority for deportation. Unfortunately, the biggest area of the announcement, which doesn't have the clarity, or really is disappointing. The clarity that's there is disappointing. Is around the criminal priorities. Mm-hmm. So ICE has long had criminal priorities. Those criminal priority categories have changed over time to make ICE look better on their annual statistics. Mm-hmm. And President Obama did say that we need to focus on criminals. That ICE needs to focus on criminals, and he introduced a new categories of criminal priorities to focus on, three new broad categories. The unfortunate part is what falls into those categories is we're back to the same problem, which are they're expansive categories. They include people that may have two very minor crimes. They include people who may have...
By minor crimes, do you mean nonviolent or do you mean misdemeanors?
I mean nonviolent and sometimes misdemeanors. It could include two misdemeanors. It doesn't have to just be a felony conviction. Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember is that what counts as a conviction for immigration purposes is different than what counts as a conviction in criminal law. So if someone has taken a diversionary program, if they received a DUI and they got help, as a strategy of dealing with those individuals, immigration will still view those as full convictions. For the purposes of immigration. So these could be people who are, reformed. This could be a conviction from, let's say, 10, 15 years ago. Someone's been here for 10 or 15 years, maybe had a DUI 10 years ago. They went through a program. They got clean. They've been fine for 10 years. That could still show up and make this make their application, problematic, potentially.
So these expansive categories, what are the three areas?
You have to give me a second to get
okay. While you're looking up that, we can have you talk about stuff you're more familiar with, and that is the situation here in Central Ohio.
Yeah, let's
focus
on that.
Any ideas how many people will be affected by this in the Columbus area?
I do. So the national averages estimates at this point are about 4.9 million. And in Ohio, it's really difficult to get state-level statistics. We have about 100,000 undocumented immigrants
in
the state of Ohio currently. If that federal rate holds, about 40,000 to 50,000 people in Ohio may benefit. And a kind of back of the envelope at this point is maybe a quarter of those, maybe 10 to 12,000 would benefit right here in Central Ohio. So it's a lot of families. It's not just the 10 to 15,000 that would benefit, but it's their families, their friends, their congregations who are going to benefit from having them home too.
The immigration community from Central America in the Columbus area, they primarily live on the west side?
Yeah, really they live all over. It's a very, widespread community, but certainly the west side is a main hub of the Latino Spanish-speaking community. The north side, sometime near Morse Road area as well, there's a large community there too.
And does the Central Ohio Workers Center work directly with the immigrant communities? Not only the Mexican community, but any of the other ones, the Somalians?
We do. We approach worker rights in a very expansive sense. So we're interested in helping anyone who can benefit
What do you mean by that, expansive?
Sure. So we're not drawing lines along language or race or background. If you're a worker and you're looking for resources in the workplace, you know, we have no preference of one community over another. We're interested in getting those resources out. That said, in our existence so far, in just this year, we have spent more time on the west side of Columbus with the large Latino Spanish-speaking community that's there. We've spent some time on the north side as well. We've done Know Your Rights workshops on the west side, and we have some upcoming workshops on the north side that will be sort of at the intersection both of the Spanish-speaking and the Somali and East African community as well. And we invite all of those people to come and get the information. And
now, do the immigrant community, documented or undocumented, do they have equal rights to unionize? Can an undocumented worker unionize? Or clearly, if they're hired at a union plant, they've got to be let into the union. But what about when they're actually unionizing?
That's right. So this is a tricky area of organizing. Worker law and labor rights law is not necessarily restricted by immigrant category. So so if you are a worker in the United States, and again, there's legal debate about this, but our take is, if you work in the United States, you're covered by labor law, and you should have that right. Absolutely.
What about wage and hour division, state or federal? Are you protected? Because a lot of times you'll hear that certain employers will be paying less than minimum wage, and sometimes I'll try to say, well, they're contract workers, and clearly they're not.
That's right, they're not. Once they have that employee-employer relationship, that becomes a labor law issue. And if you're paying someone to do work, you are subject to those minimum
wage requirements. You're telling them where to go,
that's right,
what to do, supplying the equipment, they're clearly not contractors or subcontractors.
Absolutely. So if you come in every day and someone's telling you what to do and they're telling you where to do it, that clearly falls on the side of being an employer-employee relationship.
So they can, in fact, I don't know if you recommend it, but they can actually contact the wage and hour division, either state or federally, and complain if they're not being paid?
That's right. And the same is also true if they're injured on the job as well, and they can file complaints.
Workers' compensation?
That's right. Workers' compensation.
Will they be at risk for doing that?
They could potentially be at risk. The greater risk is not, as far as we've seen, not so much backlash from the employer, but more those complaints simply aren't processed in a timely manner, and they very often only respond in sort of crisis situations. It takes months. It takes, you know, interviews to for a complaint to make it all the way through that process. And so it's actually a greater risk that they simply won't get a response from the government.
But they don't check in with ICE, the federal people in wage and hour don't refer people out, do they?
They should not. Whether or not what people do in practice varies by varies by office, and so, you know, it's uncertain. But no, they should not be doing that.
But the Central Ohio Workers Center, you would recommend workers to who aren't paid to contact the wage and hour division?
If they have a complaint, they should make a complaint. My advice would be to work with an organization who has more experience doing this, like the Central Ohio Worker Center, or an attorney, or to work in groups to make this application stronger and to make sure that other people are that there's some oversight and accountability for the federal investigation.
In the last 2 minutes here, anything you want to tell the listeners on the other side of the news about the Central Ohio Workers Center?
Yes, I would say if you have a concern about the rights and where you work in your workplace, either you or people that you work with, give us a call. We'll work with you. We'll figure out, you know, what your rights are and what we can do about it, both within the workplace, and we do many actions outside of the workplace too, both site-specific demonstrations and broad organizing and unionizing across work sites to make sure that the workers are protected.
And do they have a way to contact you? Is there a website, a Facebook?
Please, the Central Ohio Worker Center has a website. It's centralohioworkercenter.org. You can contact us through there There's links to our website. You can look up the Facebook, Central Ohio Workers Center on Facebook, and contact us that way as well.
Well, thank you, Austin Coker, for being on the other side of the news. And we hope you come back and report regularly on what the Central Ohio Workers Center is doing.
Thank you, Bob.